drink his fill. He would be filled with all the consciousness of the world. He would partake of the whole and become the whole. At last, he would know completion. But Verity himself would cease to exist. I drew back in fascinated horror. I don't think there is anything more frightening than to encounter the true will for self-destruction. Despite my own attraction to the river, it touched off an anger in me. This was not worthy of Verity. Neither the man nor the prince I had known could be capable of such a cowardly act. I looked at him as if I had never seen him, and realized how long it had been since I had seen him. The bright blackness of his eyes had become a dull darkness. The cloak that the wind snapped about him was a rent rag of a thing. The leather of his boots had long ago cracked, the stitches of the seams giving way and gaping open. The steps he took were uncertain, uneven things. Even if the wind had not buffeted him, I doubted his stride would have been steady. His lips were pale and cracked, and his flesh had a greyish overtone to it, as if the very blood of his body had forsaken it. There had been summers when he skilled against the red ships to such an extent that the flesh and muscle fell from his body, leaving him a gaunt skeleton of a man with no physical stamina. Now he was a man of stamina alone, ropey muscles stretched on a framework of bones that were scarcely cloaked in flesh at all. He was the embodiment of weary purpose. Only his will kept him upright and moving. Toward the magic flow. I do not know where I found my own will to resist it. Possibly it was because I had paused and focused myself on Verity for an instant, and seen all the world would lose if he ceased to exist as himself. Whatever the source of my strength, I pitted it against his. I threw myself into his path, but he walked through me. There was nothing to me here. "Verity, please, stop, wait!" I cried, and flung myself at him. A furious feather on the wind. I had no effect on him. He didn't even pause. "Someone has to do it," he said quietly. 3 steps later, he added, "For a time I hoped it would not be me. But over and over I have asked myself, who else then?" He turned to look at me with those burnt-to-ashes eyes. "No other answer has ever come. It has to be me." "Verity, stop!" I pleaded. But he continued to walk, not hurrying, not lagging, but simply trudging along the way a man does when he has measured the distance he must go and matched his strength to it. He had the endurance to get there, if he walked. I withdrew a bit, feeling my strength ebbing. For a moment, I feared I would lose him by being drawn back to my sleeping body. Then I realized an equally potent fear. Linked so long, and even now being pulled along after him, I might find myself drowned alongside him in that vein of magic. If I had had a body in that realm, I probably would have seized on to something and held on. As I pleaded with Verity to stop and listen to me, I instead anchored myself in the only other way I could imagine. I reached with my skill, grasping after those others whose lives touched mine, Molly, my daughter, Chade, and the Fool, Burrich and Ketrican. I had no true skill links with any of them, so my grip was a tenuous one at best, lessened by my frantic fear that at any moment Will or Carid or even Burl might somehow become aware of me. It seemed to me that it slowed Verity. "Please wait," I said again. "No," he said quietly. "Don't seek to dissuade me, Fitz. It's what I have to do." I had never thought to measure my skill strength against Verity's. I had never imagined we could be opposed to each other. But as I proceeded to batter myself against him, I felt very much like a child, kicking and screaming, as his father calmly carried him off to bed. Verity not only ignored my attack, I sensed that his will and concentration were elsewhere. He moved implacably on toward the black flow, and my consciousness was borne along with him. Self-preservation lent a frantic new strength to my struggles. I strove to push him away, to drag him back, but it availed me nothing. But there was a terrible duality to my struggle. I longed for him to win. If he overpowered me and dragged me down with him, then I need take no responsibility for it. I could open myself to that flow of power and be quenched in it. It would be an end to all torments, surcease at last. I was so tired of doubts and guilts, so weary of duties and debts. If Verity carried me into that flow of skill with him, I could finally surrender with no shame. There came a moment when we stood on the brink of that iridescent flow of power. I stared down at it with his eyes. There was no gradual shore. Instead, there was a knife's edge brink where solid earth gave way to a streaming otherness. I stared at it, seeing it as a foreign thing in our world, a warping of our very world's nature. Ponderously, Verity lowered himself to one knee. He stared into that black luminescence. I did not know if he hesitated to say farewell to our world, or if he paused to gather his will to destroy himself. My will to resist was suspended. This was a door to an otherness I could not even imagine. Hunger and curiosity drew us closer to the brink. In the next moment, he plunged his hands and forearms into the magic. I shared that sudden knowledge with him, so I screamed with him as the hot current ate the flesh and muscle from his arms. I swear I felt the acid lick of it across the bared bones of his fingers and wrist and forearm. I knew his pain, yet it was crowded from his features by the rapturous smile that overwhelmed his face. My link with him was suddenly a clumsy thing that barred me from sensing in full what he felt. I longed to be beside him, to bear my own flesh to that magic river. I shared his conviction that he could end all pain if only he would give in and plunge the rest of himself into the stream. So easy. All he had to do was lean forward a bit and let go. He crouched over the stream on his knees, sweat dripping from his face, only to disappear as tiny puffs of steam when it fell into the flow. His head was bowed, and his shoulders moved up and down with the strength of his panting. Then he begged me suddenly, in a tiny voice, "Pull me back." I had not had the strength to oppose his determination, but when I joined my will to his and together we fought the terrible allure of the power, it was just enough. He was able to draw his forearms and hands free from the stuff, though it felt as if he drew them out of solid stone. It gave him up reluctantly, and as he staggered back I sensed in full for a moment what he had shared. There was the oneness of the world flowing there like a single sweet note drawn purely out. It was not the song of humanity, but an older, greater song of vast balances and pure being. Had Verity surrendered to it, it would have ended all his torments. Instead, he tottered to his feet and turned away from it. He carried his forearms stretched out before him, palms up, the fingers curled into cups, as if he begged for something. In shape they had not changed, but now arms and fingers gleamed silver with the power that had penetrated and fused with his flesh. As he began to walk away from the stream with the same studied purposefulness with which he had approached it, I felt how his arms and hands burned as if with frostbite. "I don't understand," I said to him. "I don't want you to. Not yet." I felt a duality in him. The skill burned in him like a forge fire of incredible heat, but the strength of his body was only sufficient to keep him walking. It was effortless for him to shield my mind from the pull of that river now, but for him to move his own body up the path taxed both his flesh and his will. "Fitz, come to me, please." It was no skill order this time, not even the command of a prince, only the plea of a man to another. "I have no coterie, Fitz. Only you. If the coterie that Galen created for me had been true, then I would have more faith that what I must do is possible. Yet not only are they false to me, but they seek to defeat me. They peck at me like birds on a dying buck. I do not think their attacks can destroy me, but I fear they may weaken me enough that I do not succeed. Or worse yet, that they may distract me and succeed in my place. We cannot allow that, boy. You and I are all that stand between them and their triumph. You and I. The Farseers." I was not there in any physical sense, yet he smiled at me and lifted one terrible gleaming hand to cup my face. Did he intend what he did? I do not know. The jolt was as powerful as if a warrior had slammed his shield into my face, but not pain. Awareness, like sunlight bursting through clouds to illuminate a clearing in the forest. Everything suddenly stood out clearly, and I saw all the hidden reasons and purposes for what we did, and I understood with a painful purity of enlightenment why it was necessary I follow the path before me. Then all was gone, and I dwindled off into blackness. Verity was gone, and my understanding with him. But for that one brief instant, I had glimpsed the completeness of it. Only I remained now, but myself was so tiny, I could only exist if I held on with all my might. So I did. From a world away I heard Starling cry out in fear, "What's wrong with him?" And Chade replied gruffly, "It's only a seizure, such as he has from time to time. His head, fool. Hold his head or he'll dash his own brains out." Distantly, I felt hands gripping and restraining me. I surrendered myself to their care and sank into the darkness. I came to for a bit, some time later. I recall little of it. The fool raised my shoulders and steadied my head that I could drink from a cup, a concerned Chade held to my lips. The familiar bitterness of Elfbark puckered my mouth. I had a glimpse of Kettle standing over me, lips folded in a tight line of disapproval. Starling stood away, her eyes huge as a cornered animal's, not deigning to touch me. "That should bring him round," I heard Chade say, as I sank into a deep sleep. The next morning I arose early, despite my pounding head, and sought the baths. I slipped out so silently that the fool did not waken, but Night Eyes arose and ghosted out with me. "Where did you go last night?" he demanded. But I had no answer for him. He sensed my reluctance to think about it. "I go to hunt now," he informed me tartly. "I advise you to drink but water after this." I assented humbly, and he left me at the door of the bathhouse. Within was the mineral sink of the hot water that bubbled up from the earth. The mountain folk trapped it in great tanks and channeled it through pipes to other tubs, so that one might choose the heat and depth one wished. I scrubbed myself off in a washing tub, then submerged myself in the hottest water I could stand, and tried not to recall the scalding of the skill on Verity's forearms. I emerged red as a boiled crab. At the cool end of the bath hut, there were several mirrors on the wall. I tried not to see my own face as I shaved. It reminded me too vividly of Verity's. Some of the gauntness had left it in the last week or so, but the streak of white at my brow was back, and showed even more plainly when I bound my hair back in a warrior's tail. I would not have been surprised to see Verity's handprint on my face, or to find my scar eradicated and my nose straightened. Such had been the power of that touch. But Regal's scar on my face stood out pallidly against my steam-reddened face. Nothing had improved the broken nose. There was no outward sign of my encounter last night at all. Again and again, My mind circled back to that moment, to that touch of purest power. I fumbled to recall it, and almost could. But the absolute experience of it, like pain or pleasure, could not be recalled in full, but only in pale memory. I knew I had experienced something extraordinary. The pleasures of skilling, which all skill users were cautioned against, were like a tiny ember compared to the bonfire of knowing, feeling, and being that I had briefly shared last night. It had changed me. The anger I had been nursing toward Ketriken and Chade was gutted. I could find the emotion still, but I could not bring it back in force. I had briefly seen not only my child, but the entire situation from all possible views. There was no malice in their intent, nor even selfishness. They believed in the morality of what they did. I did not. But I could no longer deny entirely the sense of what they sought. It left me feeling soulless. They would take my child away from Molly and me. I could hate what they did. But I could not focus that anger at them. I shook my head, drawing myself back to the moment. I looked at myself in the mirror, wondering how Ketriken would see me. Did she still see the young man who had dogged Verity's steps and so often served her at court? Or would she look at my scarred face and think she did not know me, that the fits she had known was gone? Well, she knew by now how I had gained my scars. My queen should not be surprised. I would let her judge who stood behind those marks. I braced my nerves, then turned my back to the mirror. I looked over my shoulder. The center of injury in my back reminded me of a sunken red starfish in my flesh. Around it, the skin was tight and shiny. I flexed my shoulders and watched the skin tug against the scar. I extended my sword arm and felt the tiny pull of resistance there. Well, no sense worrying about it. I pulled on my shirt. I returned to the fool's hut to clothe myself afresh, and found, to my surprise, that he was dressed and ready to accompany me. Clothes were laid out on my cot, a white, loose-sleeved shirt of soft, warm wool, and dark leggings of a heavier woolen weave. There was a short, dark surcoat to match the leggings. He told me that Chade had left them. It was all very simple and plain.
"It suits you,"
the fool observed. He himself had dressed much as he did every day, in a woolen robe, but this one was dark blue with embroidery at the sleeves and hem. It was closer to what I had seen the mountain folk wear. It accentuated his pallor far more than the white one had, and made plainer to my eyes the slight tawniness of his skin, eyes, and hair were beginning to possess. His hair was as fine as ever. Left to itself, it still seemed to float freely around his face. But today, he was binding it back. "I did not know Ketriken had summoned you," I observed, to which he grimly replied,
"All the more reason to present myself. Chade came to check on you this morning and was concerned to find you gone. I think he half fears that you have run off with the wolf again. But in case you had not, he left a message for you. Other than those who have been in this hut, no one in Jampe has been told your true name, much as it must surprise you to find that the minstrel had that much discretion. Not even the healer knows who she healed. Remember, you are Tom the shepherd, until such time as Queen Ketriken feels she can speak more plainly to you. Understand?"
I sighed. I understood all too well. "I never knew Jampe to host intrigue before," I observed. He chuckled.
"You have visited here only briefly before this, believe me. Jampe breeds intrigues every bit as convoluted as Buckkeep did. As strangers here, we are wise to avoid being drawn into them, as much as we can."
"Save for the ones we bring with us," I told him, and he smiled bitterly as he nodded. The day was bright and crisp. The sky, glimpsed overhead through the dark evergreen boughs, was an endless blue. A small breeze ran alongside us, rattling dry snow crystals across the frozen tops of the snowbanks. The dry snow squeaked under our boots, and the cold roughly kissed my freshly shaven cheeks. From farther off in the village I could hear the shouts of children at play. Night Eyes pricked his ears to that, but continued to shadow us. The small voices in the distance reminded me of seabirds crying, and I suddenly missed the shores of Buck, acutely.
"You had a seizure last night?"
the fool said quietly. It was not quite a question.
"I know," I said briefly.
"Kettle seemed very distressed by it. She questioned Chade most closely about the herbs he prepared for you, and when they did not rouse you as he had said they would, she went off in her corner. She sat there most of the night, knitting loudly and peering at him disapprovingly. It was a relief to me when they all finally left."
I wondered if Starling had stayed, but did not ask it. I did not even want to know why it mattered to me.
"Who is Kettle?"
the fool asked abruptly. "Who is Kettle?" I asked, startled.
"I believe I just said that."
"Kettle is..." It suddenly seemed odd that I knew so little about someone I had travelled with so long. "I think she grew up in Buck, and then she travelled and studied scrolls and prophecies and returned to seek the White Prophet." I shrugged at the scantiness of my knowledge.
"Tell me, do you find her portentous?"
"What?"
"Do you not feel there is something about her, something that..."
He shook his head angrily. It was the first time I had ever seen the fool searching for words.
"Sometimes I feel she is significant, that she is wound up with us. Other times she seems but a nosy old woman with an unfortunate lack of taste in her choice of companions."
"You mean me?" I laughed.
"No. I mean that interfering minstrel."
"Why do you and Starling dislike one another so?" I asked tiredly.
"It is not dislike, dear Fitzy. On my part it is disinterest. Unfortunately, she cannot conceive of a man who could look at her with no interest in bedding her. She takes my simple dismissal of her as an insult, and strives to make of it some lack or fault in me, while I take offence at her proprietary attitude toward you. She has no true affection for Fitz, you know, only for being able to say she knew Fitz chivalry."
I was silent, fearing that what he said was true. And so we came to the palace at Jumpy. It was as unlike Buck Keep as I could imagine. I have heard it said that the dwellings at Jumpy owe their origins to the dome-shaped tents some of the nomadic tribes still use. The smaller dwellings were still tent-like enough that they did not startle me as the palace still did. The living heart tree that was its center pole towered immensely above us. Other secondary trees had been patiently contorted over years to form supports for the walls. When this living framework had been established, mats of bark cloth had been draped gracefully over them to form the basis for the smoothly curving walls. Plastered with a sort of clay and then painted in bright colours, the houses would always remind me of tulip buds or mushroom caps. Despite its great size, the palace seemed organic, as if it had sprouted up from the rich soil of the ancient forest that sheltered it. Size made it a palace. There were no other outward signs, no flags, no royal guards flanking the doors. No one sought to bar our entrance. The fool opened the carved wood-framed doors of a side entrance, and we went in. I followed him as he threaded his way through a maze of freestanding chambers. Other rooms were on platforms above us, reached by ladders, or, for the grander ones, staircases of wood. The walls of the chambers were flimsy things, with some temporary rooms of no more than bark-cloth tapestries stretched on frameworks. The inside of the palace was but only slightly warmer than the forest outside. The individual chambers were heated by freestanding braziers in the winter. I followed the fool to a chamber whose outer walls were decorated with delicate illustrations of water birds. This was a more permanent room, with sliding wooden doors likewise carved with birds. I could hear the notes of Starling's harp from within and the murmur of low voices. He tapped at the door, waited briefly, and then slid it open to admit us. Ketrickin was within, and the fool's friend Joffrun, and several other people I did not recognize. Starling sat on a low bench to one side, playing softly while Ketrickin and the others embroidered a quilt on a frame that almost filled the room. A bright garden of flowers was being created on the quilt top. Chade sat not far from Starling. He was dressed in a white shirt and dark leggings with a long wool vest, gaily embroidered, over the shirt. His hair was pulled back in a grey warrior's tail, with the leather band on his brow bearing the buck sigil. He looked decades younger than he had in Buckkeep. They spoke together more softly than the music. Ketrickin looked up, needle in hand, and greeted us calmly. She introduced me to the others as Tom, and politely asked if I were recovering well from my injury. I told her I was, and she bade me be seated and rest myself a bit. The fool circled the quilt, complimented Joffrun on her stitchery, and when she invited him, he took a place beside her. He took up a needle and floss, threaded it, and began adding butterflies of his own invention to one corner of the quilt, while he and Joffrun talked softly of gardens they had known. He seemed very at ease. I felt at a loss, sitting idly in a room full of quietly occupied people. I waited for Ketrickin to speak to me, but she went on with her work. Starling's eyes met mine, and she smiled, but stiffly. Chade avoided my glance, looking past me, as if we were strangers. There was conversation in the room, but it was soft and intermittent. Mostly requests for a skein of thread to be passed, or comments on each other's work. Starling played the old familiar buck ballads, but wordlessly. No one spoke to me, or paid me any mind. I waited. After a time, I began to wonder if it was a subtle form of punishment. I tried to remain relaxed, but tension repeatedly built up in me. Every few minutes I would remember to unclench my jaws and loosen my shoulders. It took some time for me to see a similar anxiety in Ketrickin. I had spent many hours attending my lady in Buckkeep when she had first come to court. I had seen her lethargic at her needlework, or lively in her garden. But now she sewed furiously, as if the fate of the six duchies depended on her completing this quilt. She was thinner than I recalled, the bones and planes of her face showing more plainly. Her hair, a year after she had cut it to mourn verity, was still too short for her to confine it well. The pale strands of it constantly crept forward. There were lines in her face, around her eyes and mouth, and she frequently chewed on her lips, a thing I had never seen her do before. The mornings seemed to drag on, but finally one of the young men sat up straight, then stretched, and declared his eyes were getting too weary for him to do any more today. He asked the woman at his side if she had a mind to hunt with him today, and she readily agreed. As if this were some sort of signal, the others began to rise and stretch and make their farewells to Ketrickin. I was struck at their familiarity with her, until I recalled that here she was not regarded as queen, but as eventual sacrifice to the mountains. Her role among her folk would never be seen as that of ruler, but as guide and coordinator. Her father, King Eod, was known amongst his own folk as the Sacrifice, and was expected to be ever and always unselfishly available to his folk, to help in any way they might require. It was a position that was both less regal than that of buck royalty, and more beloved. I wondered idly if it might not have suited Verity more to have come here and been Ketrickin's consort. "Fitz chivalry!" I looked up to Ketrickin's command. Only she, I, Starling, Chade, and the fool remained in the room. I almost looked to Chade for direction, but his eyes had excluded me earlier. I sensed I was on my own here. The tone of Ketrickin's voice made this a formal interview. I stood straight, and then managed a rather stiff bow. "My queen, you summoned me. Explain yourself." The wind outside was warmer than her voice. I glanced up at her eyes. Blue ice. I lowered my gaze and took a breath. "Shall I report, my queen?" "If it will explain your failures, do so." That startled me. My eyes flew to hers, but though our glances met, there was no meeting. All the girl in Ketrickin had burned away, as the impurities are burned and beaten from iron ore in a foundry. With it seemed to have gone any feeling for her husband's bastard nephew. She sat before me as ruler and judge, not friend. I had not expected to feel that loss so keenly. Despite my better judgment, I let ice creep into my own voice. "I shall submit to my queen's judgment on that," I offered. She was merciless. She had me start not with my own death, but days before that, when we had first begun plotting to whisk King Shrewd secretly from Buckkeep and Regal's reach. I stood before her, and had to admit that the coastal dukes had approached me with the offer of recognizing me as king-in-waiting rather than Regal. Worse, I had to tell her that although I had refused that, I had promised to stand with them, assuming the command of Buckkeep Castle and the protection of Buck's Coast. Chade had once warned me that it was as close to treason as made no difference, but I was tired to death of all my secrets, and I relentlessly bared them. More than once I wished Starling were not in the room, for I dreaded hearing my own words made into a song denouncing me. But if my queen deemed her worthy of confidence, it was not my place to question it. So I went on, down the weary track of days. For the first time she heard from me how King Shrewd had died in my arms, and how I had hunted down and killed both Serene and Justin in the great hall before everyone. When it came to my days in Regal's dungeon, she had no pity on me. Had me beaten and starved, and I would have perished there if I had not feigned death, I said. It was not good enough for her. No one, not even Burridge, had known a full telling of those days. I steeled myself and launched into it. After a time, my voice began to shake. I faltered in my telling. Then I looked past her at the wall, took a breath, and went on. I glanced at her once to find her gone white as ice. I stopped thinking of the events behind my words. I heard my own voice dispassionately relating all that had happened. I heard Ketrickin draw in her breath when I spoke of skilling to Verity from my cell. Other than that, there was not a sound in the room. Once my eyes wandered to Chade, I found him sitting deathly still, his jaw set, as if he endured some torment of his own. I forged my way on through the story, telling, without judgment, of my own resurrection by Burridge and Chade, of the wit magic that made it possible, and of the days that followed. I told of our angry parting, of my journeys in detail, of the times when I could sense Verity, and the brief joinings we shared. Of my attempt on Regal's life, and even of how Verity had unwillingly implanted into my soul his command to come to him. On and on, my voice getting huskier as my throat and mouth dried with the telling. I did not pause nor rest until I had finished telling her of my final staggering trek into Jampe. And when at last my full tale of days was told out to her, I continued to stand, emptied and weary. Some people say there is a relief in the sharing of cares and pains. To me, there was no catharsis, only an unearthing of rotting corpses of memories, a bearing of still suppurating wounds. After a time of silence, I found the cruelty to ask,
Does my account excuse my failures, my queen? But if I had thought to rend her, I failed there also.
You make no mention of your daughter, Fitzchivalry.
It was true. I had not made mention of Molly and the child. Fear sliced through me like a cold blade. I had not thought of her as pertaining to my report. She obviously must. Queen Ketrickin said implacably. I forced myself to look at her. She clasped her hands before her. Did they tremble? Did she feel any remorse? For what she said next, I could not tell. Given her lineage, she much more than pertains to this discussion. Ideally, she should be here, where we could guarantee a measure of safety to the Farseer heir. I imposed calm on my voice. My queen, you are mistaken in naming her so. Neither I nor she have any legitimate claim to the throne. We are both illegitimate. Ketrickin was shaking her head.
We do not consider what is or is not between you and her mother. We consider only her bloodline. Irregardless of what you may claim for her, her lineage will claim her. I am childless.
Until I heard her speak that word aloud, I did not grasp what her depth of pain was. A few moments ago, I had thought her heartless. Now I wondered if she was completely sane any more. Such was the grief and despair that one word conveyed. She forced herself on.
There must be an heir to the Farseer throne. Chaid has advised me that alone I cannot rally the people to protect themselves. I am too foreign to their eyes still. But no matter how they see me, I remain their queen. I have a duty to do. I must find a way to unite the six duchies and repulse the invaders from our shores. To do that, they must have a leader. I had thought to offer you. But he has said that they will not accept you either. That matter of your supposed death and use of beast magic is too big an obstacle. That being so, there remains only your child of the Farseer line. Regal has proven false to his own blood. She, then, must be sacrifice for our people. They will rally to her.
I dared to speak. She is only an infant, my queen. How can she—
She is a symbol. It is all the people will require of her right now, that she exist. Later, she will be their queen in truth. I felt as if she had knocked the wind from me. She spoke on. I shall be sending Chaid to fetch her here, where she may be kept safe and properly educated as she grows.
She sighed.
I would like her mother to be with her. Unfortunately, we must present the child as mine. Somehow. How I hate such deceptions. But Chaid has convinced me of the necessity. I hope he will also be able to convince your daughter's mother. More to herself, she added. We shall have to say that we said my child was stillborn to make Regal believe. There was no heir to threaten. My poor little son. His people will never know he was born. And that, I suppose, is how he is sacrifice for them.
I found myself looking at Ketrickin closely, and finding there remained very little of the queen I had known at Buckkeep. I hated what she was saying. It outraged me. Yet my voice was gentle as I asked.
Why is any of this necessary, my queen? King Verity lives. I shall find him and do all I can to return him to you. Together you shall rule at Buckkeep, and your children after you.
Shall he?
Will we? Will they?
Almost she shook her head in denial.
It may be, Fitzchivalry. But for too long I put my faith in believing that things would turn out as they should. I will not fall prey to those expectations again. Some things must be made certain before further risks can be taken.
An heir to the Farseer line must be assured. She met my eyes calmly. I have made up the declaration and given a copy to Chade, with another to be kept safely here. Your child is heir to the throne, Fitzchivalry. I had been keeping my soul intact with a tiny hope for so long, for so many months. I had lured myself along with the idea that when all was over and done, I could somehow go back to Molly and win again her love, that I could claim my daughter as my own. Other men might dream of high honors, or riches, or deeds of valor sung by minstrels. I wanted to come to a small cot as light faded, to sit in a chair by a fire, my back aching from work, my hands rough with toil, and hold a little girl in my lap, while a woman who loved me told me of her day, of all the things I had ever had to give up simply by virtue of the blood I carried. That was the dearest. Must I now surrender that? Must I become, to Molly, forever the man who had lied to her, who had left her with child and never returned, and then caused that child to be stolen from her as well? I had not meant to speak aloud. I did not realize I had until the Queen replied. That is what it is to be sacrifice, Fitzchivalry. Nothing can be held back for oneself. Nothing. I will not acknowledge her, then. The words burned my tongue to speak them. I will not claim her as mine. You need not. I shall claim her as mine. No doubt she will carry the Farseer looks. Your blood is strong. For our purposes, it is sufficient that I know the child is yours. You have already acknowledged that to Starling, the minstrel. To her you said you had fathered a child with Molly, a candlemaker from Buckkeep Town. In all of the 6 duchies, the witness of a minstrel is recognized by law. She has already set her hand to the document, with her oath, that she knows the child to be a true Farseer. Fitzchivalry. She went on, and her voice was almost kind, though my ears rang to hear her words, and I near reeled where I stood. No one can escape fate. Not you. Not your daughter. Step back and see, this is why she came to be. When all circumstances conspired to deny the Farseer line an heir, somehow one was yet made. By you. Accept and endure. They were the wrong words. She might have been raised to them, but I had been told, the fight is not over until you have won it. I lifted my eyes and looked around at them all. I don't know what they saw on my face, but their faces became still. I can find Verity, I said quietly. And I will. They were silent. You want your king, I said to Ketrigan. I waited until I saw assent in her face. I want my child, I said quietly. What are you saying? Ketrigan demanded coldly. I am saying that I want the same things you do. I wish to be with the one I love, to raise our child with her. I met her eyes. Tell me I can have that. It is all I have ever wanted. She met my eyes squarely. I cannot make you that promise, Fitzchivalry. She is too important for simple love to claim her. The words struck me as both utterly absurd and completely true. I bowed my head in what was not assent. I stared a hole into the floor, trying to find other choices, other ways. I know what you will say next, Ketrigan said bitterly, that if I claim your child for the throne, you will not help me find Verity. I have considered long and well, knowing that this will sever me from your help. I am prepared to seek him out on my own. I have the map. Somehow I shall... Ketrigan. I cut into her speech with her name, said quietly, bereft of her title. I had not meant to.
I saw it startled her. I found myself slowly shaking my head.
"You do not understand.
Were Molly standing here before me with our daughter, still I would have to seek my king. No matter what is done to me, no matter how I am wronged, still, I must seek verity." My words changed the faces in the room. Chade lifted his head and looked at me with fierce pride shining in his eyes. Ketrickin turned aside, blinking at tears. I think she may have felt slightly ashamed. To the fool, I was once more his catalyst. In Starling there bloomed the hope that I might still be worthy of a legend. But in me, there was the overriding hunger for the absolute. Verity had shown it to me in its pure physical form. I would answer my king's skill command, and serve him as I had vowed. But another call beckoned me now as well. The skill. 23. The Mountains. One might suppose that the Mountain Kingdom, with its sparse hamlets and scattered folk, was a new realm but recently gathered together. In truth, its history far predates any of the written records of the six duchies. To call this region a kingdom is truly a misnomer. In ancient times, the diverse hunters, herders, and farmers, both nomadic and settled, gradually gave their allegiance to a judge, a woman of great wisdom, who resided at Jampe. Although this person has come to be called the king or queen of the mountains by outsiders, to the residents of the mountain kingdom, he or she is still the sacrifice, the one who is willing to give all, even life, for the sake of those who are ruled. The first judge who lived at Jampe is now a shadowy figure of legend, her deeds known only by the songs of her that mountain folk still sing. Yet old as those songs are, there is an even older rumor of a more ancient ruler and capital city. The Mountain Kingdom, as we know it today, consists almost entirely of the wandering folk and settlements on the eastern flanks of the mountains. Beyond the mountains lie the icy shores that border the White Sea. Some few trade routes still meander through the sharp teeth of the mountains to reach the hunting folk who live in that snowy place. To the south of the mountains are the unsettled forests of the Rain Wilds, and somewhere the source of the Rain River, that is the trade boundary of the Chalced States. These are the only lands and folks that have been truly chartered beyond the mountains. Yet there have always been legends of another land, one locked and lost in the peaks, beyond the mountain kingdom. As one travels deeper in the mountains, past the boundaries of the folk who owe allegiance to Jampe, the land becomes even more rugged and unyielding. Snow never leaves the taller peaks, and some valleys host only glacial ice. In some areas, it is said that great steams and smoke pour up from cracks in the mountains, and that the earth may tremble quietly, or wrench itself in violent shakings. There are few reasons for anyone to venture into that region of scree and cliffs. Hunting is easier and more profitable on the greener slopes of the mountains. There is insufficient grazing to lure any shepherd's flocks. Regarding that land, we have the usual tales that distant lands spawn. Dragons and giants, ancient tumble-down cities, savage unicorns, treasure hoards and secret maps, dusty streets paved with gold, valleys of eternal spring where the water rises steaming from the ground, dangerous sorcerers spell-locked in caves of gems and ancient sleeping evils embedded in the earth. All are said to reside in the ancient, nameless land beyond the boundaries of the mountain kingdom. Ketrickin truly had expected me to refuse to help her search for Verity. In the days of my convalescence she had determined she would seek for him on her own, and to that end she had mustered supplies and animals. In the six duchies, a queen would have had the royal treasury to draw on,
as well the enforced largesse of her nobles. Such was not the case in the Mountain Kingdom. Here, while King Eod remained alive, she was no more than a younger relative of the sacrifice. While it was expected that she would succeed him some day, it gave her no right to command the wealth of her people. In truth, even were she sacrifice, she would have not had access to riches and resources. The sacrifice and his immediate family lived simply within their beautiful dwelling. All of Jumpe, the palace, the gardens, the fountains, all belonged to the folk of the Mountain Kingdom. The sacrifice did not want for anything, but neither did he possess excess. So Ketriken turned not to royal coffers and nobles eager to curry favour, but to old friends and cousins for what she needed. She had approached her father, but he had told her firmly but sadly that finding the king of the six duchies was her concern, not that of the Mountain Kingdom. Much as he grieved with his daughter over the disappearance of the man she loved, he could not divert supplies from defending the Mountain Kingdom from Regal of the six duchies. Such was the bond between them that she could accept his refusal with understanding. It shamed me to think of the rightful queen of the six duchies turning to the charity of her relatives and friends, but only when I was not nursing my resentment toward her. She had designed the expedition to her convenience, not mine. I approved of little of it. In the days before we departed, she deigned to consult me on some aspects of it, but my opinions were overridden as often as they were listened to. We spoke to one another, civilly, without the warmth of either anger or friendship. There were many areas where we disagreed, and when we did, she did as she judged wisest. Unspoken, but implied, was that my judgment in the past had been faulty and short-sighted. I wanted no beasts of burden that might starve and freeze. Block as I might, the wit left me vulnerable to their pain. Ketriken, however, had procured half a dozen creatures that she claimed did not mind snow and cold, and browsed rather than grazed. They were Jepas, creatures native to some of the remoter parts of the Mountain Kingdom. They reminded me of long-necked goats with paws instead of hooves. I had small faith that they would be able to carry enough to make them worth the nuisance of dealing with them. Ketriken told me calmly that I would soon get used to them. It all depends on how they taste, Night Eyes suggested philosophically. I was prone to agree with him. Her choice of companions for the expedition irked me even more. I saw no sense to her risking herself, but on that point I knew better than to argue. I resented Starling's going once I discovered what she had bargained to be allowed to go. Her reason was still to find a song that would make her reputation. She had bought her place in our group by her unspoken trade, that only if she were allowed to go would she make written record that Molly's child was mine also. She knew I felt she had betrayed me, and wisely avoided my company after that. With us would go three cousins of Ketriken's, all big, stoutly muscled folk, well practiced in travelling through the mountains. It would not be a large party. Ketriken assured me that if six were not enough to find Verity, then 600 would not suffice. I agreed with her that it was easier to supply a smaller party, and that often they travelled faster than large groups. Chade was not to be of our party. He was going back to Buckkeep to bear the tidings to patience that Ketriken would seek out Verity, and to plant the seeds of rumour that there was, indeed, an heir to the Six Duchies' throne. He would also be seeing Burridge and Molly, and the child. He had offered to let Molly and Patience and Burridge know that I was still alive. The offer had come awkwardly, for he knew full well that I hated the part he had played in claiming my daughter for the throne. But I swallowed my anger and spoke to him politely, and was rewarded with his solemn promise that he would say nothing of me to any of them. At the time, it seemed like the wisest course. I felt that only I could fully explain to Molly why I had acted as I had, and she had already mourned me as dead once.
if I did not survive this quest, she would not grieve any more than she had. Chade came to bid me farewell the night he left for Buck. At first we both tried to pretend that all was well between us. We talked of small things that had once mattered to both of us. I felt genuine loss when he told me of Slink's death. I tried to talk him into taking Ruddy and Sooty with him to return them to Burridge's care. Ruddy needed a firmer hand than he was getting, and the stallion could be far more than transportation to Burridge. His stud service could be sold, or traded, and Sooty's foal represented more wealth to come, but Chade shook his head and said he must travel swiftly and attract no attention. One man with three horses was a target for bandits, if nothing else. I had seen the vicious little gelding Chade had for a mount. Bad-tempered as he was tough and agile and, Chade assured me, very swift in a chase over bad terrain. He grinned as he said it, and I knew that that particular ability of the horse had been well tested. The fool was right, I thought then bitterly. War and intrigue did agree with him. I looked at him, in his tall boots and swirling cloak, at the rampant buck he wore so openly on his brow above his green eyes, and tried to equate him with the gentle-handed old man who had schooled me in how to kill people. His years were there still, but he carried them differently. Privately, I wondered what drugs he used to prolong his energy. Yet as different as he was still Chade. I wanted to reach out to him and know that there was still a bond of some kind between us, but I could not. I could not understand myself. How could his opinion still matter so much to me when I knew he was willing to take my child and my happiness for the sake of the Farseer throne? I felt it was a weakness in myself that I could not find the strength of will to hate him. I reached for that hatred, and came up with only a boyish sulkiness that kept me from clasping his hand at his departure, or wishing him well. He ignored my surliness, which made me feel even more childish. After he was gone, the fool gave me the leather saddlebag he had left for me. Inside was a very serviceable sheath-knife, a small pouch of coins, and a selection of poisons and healing herbs, including a generous supply of elf bark, wrapped and carefully labeled that it should be used only with the greatest caution and in the greatest need, was a small paper of carrot seed. In a battered leather sheath was a plain but serviceable short sword. I felt a sudden anger at him that I could not explain. "It is so typical of him," I exclaimed, and dumped the bag out on the table for the fool to witness. "Poison and knives! That is what he thinks of me. This is still how he sees me. Death is all he can imagine for me."
"I doubt he expected you to use them on yourself,"
the fool observed mildly. He pushed the knife away from the marionette he was stringing.
"Perhaps he thought you might use them to protect yourself."
"Don't you understand?" I demanded of him. "These are gifts for the boy Chade taught to be an assassin. He can't see that isn't who I am any longer. He can't forgive me for wanting a life of my own."
"Any more than you can forgive him for no longer being your benevolent and indulgent tutor,"
the fool observed dryly. He was knotting the strings from the control paddles to the marionette's limbs.
"It's a bit of a threat, isn't it? To see him stride about like a warrior, putting himself joyfully in danger for something he believes in, flirting with women, and generally acting as if he's claimed a life of his own for himself."
It was like a dash of cold water in the face. Almost I had to admit my jealousy that Chade had boldly seized what still eluded me.
"That isn't it at all!"
I snarled at the fool. The marionette he was working on wagged a rebuking finger at me, while the fool smirked at me over his head. It had an uncanny resemblance to Ratsy.
"What I see,"
he observed, to no one in particular,
"is that it is not Verity's buckhead he wears on his brow. No. The sigil he chose is more like one that Prince Verity chose for his bastard nephew. Do not you see a resemblance?
I was silent for a time. Then, what of it? I asked grudgingly. The fool swung his marionette to the floor, where the bony creature shrugged eerily.
Neither King Shrewd's death nor Verity's supposed death flushed that weasel out of hiding. Only when he believed you murdered did anger flare up in him hot enough for him to fling aside all hiding and pretense and declare he would yet see a true farseer on the throne.
The marionette wagged a finger at me. Are you trying to say he does this for me, for my sake? When the last thing I would wish is to see the throne claim my child? The marionette crossed its arms and wagged its head, thoughtfully.
It seems to me that Chade has always done what he thought was best for you, whether you agreed or not. Perhaps he extends that to your daughter. She would be, after all, his grandniece, and the last living remnant of his bloodline, excluding Regal and yourself, of course.
The marionette danced a few steps.
How else would you expect a man that old to provide for a child so young? He does not expect to live forever. Perhaps he thought she would be safer astride a throne than ridden over by another who wished to claim it.
I turned away from the fool and made some pretense of gathering clothing to wash. It would take me a long time to think through what he had said. I was willing to accept Ketrigan's choice of tents and clothing for her expedition, and honest enough to be grateful that she saw fit to provide for my clothing and shelter as well. Had she excluded me totally from her entourage, I could not have completely faulted her. Instead, Geoffron came one day, bearing a stack of clothing and bedding for me, and to measure my feet for the sack-like boots the mountain folk favored. She proved merry company, for she and the fool exchanged playful barbs all the while. His fluency in Tjurda exceeded my own, and at times I was hard-pressed to follow the conversation, while half of the fool's word-plays escaped me. I wondered, in passing, exactly what went on between those two. When I had first arrived, I had thought her some sort of disciple to him. Now I wondered if she had not affected that interest simply as an excuse to be near him. Before she left, she measured the fool's feet as well, and asked him questions as to what colours and trims he wished worked into the boots. "New boots?" I asked him after she had gone. "As little as you venture outside, I would scarcely think you need them." He gave me a level look. The recent merriment faded from his face.
"You know I must go with you,"
he pointed out calmly. He smiled an odd smile.
"Why else do you think we have been brought together in this far place? It is by the interaction of the Catalyst and the White Prophet that the events of this time shall be returned to their proper course. I believe that if we succeed, the Red Ships will be driven from the Six Duchies coast, and a Farseer will inherit a throne." "That would seem to fit most of the prophecies,"
Kettle agreed from her hearth-corner. She was tying off the last row of knitting on a thick mitten.
"If the plague of the mindless hunger is forging, and your actions put a stop to that, that would fit another prophecy as well."
Kettle's knack of providing a prophecy for every occasion was beginning to grate on me. I took a breath, and then asked the fool, "And what does Queen Ketrigan say about your joining her party?"
"I haven't discussed it with her,"
he replied blithely.
"I am not joining her, Fitz. I am following you."
A sort of bemusement came over his face.
"I have known since I was a child that together we should do this task. It had not occurred to me to question that I would go with you. I have been making preparations since the day you arrived here." "As have I,"
Kettle observed quietly. We both turned to stare at her. She feigned not to notice as she tried on the mitten and admired its fit. "No," I said bluntly. Bad enough to look forward to dying pack animals, I was not going to witness the death of another friend. It was too obvious a voice that she was hopelessly too old for such a trek.
I thought you might stay here in my home.
The fool offered more gently.
There is plenty of firewood for the rest of the winter and some supplies of meal, and I expect to die on the journey if it's any comfort to you.
She took off the mitten and set it with its mate. Casually, she inspected what was left of her skein of wool. She began to cast on stitches, the yarn flowing effortlessly through her fingers.
And you needn't worry about me before then. I've made provision for myself. I've done a bit of trading, and I have the food and such that I'll need.
She glanced up at me from her needles, and added quietly,
I have the wherewithal to see this journey through to the end.
I had to admire her calm assumption that her life was still her own, to do with as she wished. I wondered when I'd begun to think of her as a helpless old woman that someone would have to look after now. She looked back down to her knitting. Needlessly, for her fingers continued to work whether she watched them or not.
I see you understand me,
she said quietly. And that was that. I have never known any expedition to get off exactly as planned. Generally, the larger one is, the more difficulties it has. Ours was no exception. The morning before we were scheduled to depart, I was rudely shaken out of my sleep.
Get up, Fitz. We have to leave now.
Ketrickin said tersely. I sat up slowly. I was wide awake instantly, but my healing back still did not encourage me to move swiftly. The fool was sitting on the edge of his bed, looking more anxious than I had ever seen him.
What is it?
I demanded.
Regal!
I had never heard so much venom in one word. Her face was very white, and she knotted and unknotted her fists at her side.
He has sent a courier under a truce flag to my father, saying that we harbour a known traitor to the six duchies. He says that if we release you to him, he will see it as a sign of good faith with the six duchies and will not consider us an enemy. But if we do not, he will loose the troops he has poised on our borders, for he will know that we plot with his enemies against him.
She paused.
My father is considering what to do.
Ketrickin, I am but the excuse. I protested. My heart was hammering in my chest. Night eyes whined anxiously.
You must know it has taken him months to mass these troops. They are not there because I am here. They are in place because he plans to move against the Mountain Kingdom, no matter what. You know, Regal. It is all a bluff to see if he can get you to turn me over to him. Once you do, he will find some other pretext to attack.
I am not a simpleton, she said coldly. Our watchers have known of the troops for weeks. We have been doing what we can to prepare ourselves. Always our mountains have been our strongest defense. But never before have we confronted an organized foe in such numbers. My father is sacrifice, Fitz. He must do whatever will best serve the Mountain Kingdom. So now he must ponder if by turning you over he will have a chance to treat with Regal. Do not think my father is stupid enough to trust him, but the longer he can delay an attack against his people, the better prepared they will be.
It sounds as if there is little left to decide, I said bitterly.
There was no reason for my father to make me privy to the courier's message,
Ketrickin observed.
The decision is his.
Her eyes met mine squarely, and held a shadow of our old friendship.
I think perhaps he offers me a chance to spirit you away. Before I would be defying his orders to turn you over to Regal. Perhaps he thinks to tell Regal you have escaped, but he intends to track you down.
Behind Ketrickin, the fool was pulling on leggings under his nightshirt.
It will be harder than I had planned, Ketrickin confided in me. I cannot involve any other mountain folk in this. It will have to be you, me, and Starling. Alone. And we must leave now, within the hour.
I'll be ready. I promised her.
Meet me behind Joss's woodshed, she said,
and left. I looked at the fool. So, do we tell Kettle?
Why are you asking me?
He demanded. I gave a small shrug.
Then I got up and began dressing hastily. I thought of all the small ways in which I was not prepared, and then gave it up as useless. In a very short time the fool and I shouldered our packs. Night Eyes rose, stretched thoroughly, and went to the door to precede us.
I shall miss the fireplace, but the hunting will be better.
He accepted all so calmly. The fool took a careful look around the hut, and then closed the door behind us.
"That's the first place I've ever lived that was solely mine,"
he observed, as we walked away from it.
"You leave so much behind to do this,"
I said awkwardly, thinking of his tools, his half-finished puppets, even the plants growing inside by the window. Despite myself, I felt responsible for it. Perhaps it was because I was so glad that I was not going on alone. He glanced over at me and shrugged.
"I take myself with me. That's all I truly need."
"Or own?"
He glanced back at the door he had painted himself.
"Geoffron will take good care of it. And of Kettle, too."
I wondered if he left behind more than I knew. We were nearly to the woodshed when I saw some children racing down the path toward us.
"There he is!"
one cried, pointing. I shot a startled glance at the fool, then braced myself, wondering what was to come. How could one defend oneself against children? At a loss, I awaited the attack. But the wolf did not wait. He sank low to his belly in the snow, even his tail flat. As the children closed the distance, he suddenly shot forward straight at the leader.
"No!"
I cried aloud in horror, but none of them paid me any heed. The wolf's front paws struck the boy's chest to drive him down hard into the snow. In a flash, Night Eyes was up and after the others, who fled, shrieking with laughter, as one after another he caught up with them and mowed them down. By the time he'd felled the last one, the first boy was up and after him, vainly trying to keep up with the wolf and making wild grabs at his tail as Night Eyes flashed by him, tongue lolling. He felled them all again, twice more, before he halted in one of his racing loops. He watched the children getting to their feet, then glanced over his shoulder at me. He folded his ears down abashedly, then looked back to the children, his tail wagging low. One girl was already digging a chunk of flatbread out of her pocket, while another teased him with a strip of leather, snaking it over the snow and trying to get him involved in a tug of war. I feigned not to notice.
"I'll catch up with you later,"
he offered. "No doubt," I told him dryly. The fool and I kept walking. I glanced back once to see the wolf, teeth set in the leather and all 4 feet braced while 2 boys dragged at the other end of it. I surmised that I now knew how he had been spending his afternoons. I think I felt a pang of envy. Ketrickin was already waiting. 6 laden jeppas were roped together in a train. I wished now I had taken the time to learn more about them, but I had assumed the others would have the care of them.
"We're still taking all of them?" I asked in dismay.
"It would take too long to unpack the loads and repack, with only what we need. Perhaps later we'll abandon the extra supplies and animals, but for now I simply wish to be gone as soon as possible."
"Then let's leave," I suggested.
Ketrickin looked pointedly at the fool.
"What are you doing here? Wishing Fitz farewell?"
"I go where he does,"
the fool said quietly. The queen looked at him, and something in her face almost softened.
"It will be cold, fool. I have not forgotten how you suffered from the cold on the way here. Where we go now, the cold will linger long after spring has reached Champe."
"I go where he does,"
the fool repeated, quietly. Ketrickin shook her head to herself. Then she shrugged. She strode to the lead of the line of jeppas and snapped her fingers. The lead animal flapped his hairy ears and followed her. The others followed him. Their obedience impressed me. I quested briefly toward them and found such a strong herd instinct at work that they scarcely thought of themselves as separate animals. As long as the lead animal followed Ketrikin, there would be no problems with the others. Ketrikin led us along a trail that was little more than a path. It wound mostly behind the scattered cottages that housed the winter residents of Jampe. In a very short time, we left the last of the huts behind and travelled through ancient forest. The fool and I walked behind the string of animals. I watched the one in front of us, marking how his wide, flat feet spread on the snow, much as the wolf's did. They set a pace slightly faster than a comfortable walk. We had not gone too far before I heard a shout behind us. I flinched and glanced hastily over my shoulder. It was Starling, coming at a run, her pack jouncing on her shoulders. When she came up to us, she said accusingly, "You left without me." The fool grinned. I shrugged. "I left when my queen commanded it," I observed. She glared at us, and then hurried past us, floundering through the loose snow beside the trail to pass the Jepas to catch up with Ketrikin. Their voices carried clearly in the cold air. "I told you I was leaving right away," the queen said tersely. "Then I did." To my amazement, Starling had the sense to be quiet. For a brief time she struggled along in the loose snow beside Ketrikin. Then she gradually gave it up, letting first the Jepas, and then the fool and me, pass her. She fell in behind me. I knew our pace would be difficult for her to match. I felt sorry for her. Then I thought of my daughter, and did not even look back to see if she was keeping up. It was the beginning of a long, uneventful day. The path led always uphill, never steeply, but the constant grade was taxing. Ketrikin did not let up on the pace, but kept us moving steadily. None of us talked much. I was too busy breathing and trying to ignore the gradually increasing ache in my back. Sound flesh covered the arrow wound now, but the muscles under it still complained of their new healing. Great trees towered above us. Most of the trees were evergreens, some of kinds I had never seen before. They made a perpetual twilight of the brief winter day's grayness. There was little underbrush to struggle with. Most of the scenery was of the staggered ranks of immense trunks and a few low-swooping branches. For the most part, the live branches of the trees began far over our heads. From time to time we passed patches of smaller deciduous trees that had sprung up in patches of open forest made by a great tree's demise. The path was well packed, evidently used often by animals and by folk on skis. It was narrow, and if one did not pay attention, it was easy to step off the path and sink surprisingly deep in the unpacked snow. I tried to pay attention. The day was mild by mountain standards, and I soon discovered that the clothing Ketrikin had procured for me was very efficient at keeping me warm. I loosened my coat at the throat, and then the collar of my shirt to let body heat escape. The fool threw back the fur-rimmed hood of his coat to reveal that he wore a gay woolen hat within it. I watched the tassel on the end of it bobbing as he walked. If the pace bothered him, he said nothing about it. Perhaps, like me, he had no breath left to complain. Shortly after midday, Night Eyes joined us. "Good doggy," I observed aloud to him. "This pales in comparison to what Kettle is calling you," he observed smugly. "I pity you all when the old bitch catches up with the pack. She has a stick. Is she following us? She tracks quite well for a noseless human." Night Eyes trotted past us, moving with surprising ease, even in the unpacked snow, to the side of the trail. I could tell he was enjoying the ripple of unease that his scent pushed through the trailing Jepas. I watched him as he passed them all, and then Ketrikin. Once he was in the lead, he ranged confidently ahead, just as if he knew where we were going. I soon lost sight of him, but I did not worry. I knew he would circle back often to check on us.
"Kettle is following us," I told the fool.
He shot me a questioning look.
"Night Eye says she is quite angry with us."
His shoulders rose and fell in a quick sigh.
"Well, she has a right to her own decision,"
he observed to himself. Then to me he added,
"It still unnerves me a bit when you and the wolf do that."
"Does it bother you?"
"That I'm witted."
"Does it bother you to meet my eyes?"
he rejoined.
It was enough.
We kept walking. Ketrickin held us to a steady pace for as long as the daylight lasted. A trampled area under the shelter of some of the great trees was our stopping place. While it did not look frequently used, we were on some sort of trader's trail to Jumpe. Ketrickin was matter-of-fact in her total command of us. She gestured Starling to a small rick of dry firewood protected from the snow by canvas.
"Use some to get a fire started, and then take care to replace at least as much as we use. Many folk stop here, and in foul weather, a life may depend on that wood being there."
Starling meekly obeyed. She directed the fool and I as we assisted her in setting up a shelter. When we were finished, we had a tent shaped rather like the cap of a mushroom. That done, she portioned out the tasks of unloading bedding and moving it into the tent, unloading the animals and picketing the lead animal, and melting snow for water. She herself shared fully in the tasks. I watched the efficiency with which she established our camp and saw to our needs. With a pang, I realized she reminded me of Verity. She would have made a good soldier. Once our basic camp was established, the fool and I exchanged glances. I went to where Ketrickin was checking our jeppers. Those hardy beasts were already at work, nibbling bud tips and bark from the smaller trees that fronted one side of the camp.
"I think Kettle may be following us," I told her.
"Do you think I should go back and look for her?"
"To what end?"
Ketrickin asked me. The question sounded callous, but she went on.
"If she can catch up with us, then we will share what we have. You know that. But I suspect that she will weary before she gets here and turn back to Jumpe. Perhaps she has already turned back, and perhaps she has become exhausted and sunk down by the side of the trail," I thought. But I did not go back.
I recognized in Ketrickin's words the harsh practicality of the mountain folk. She would respect Kettle's decision to follow us, even if her attempt to do so killed her. Ketrickin would not interfere with her own will for herself. I knew that among the mountain folk, it was not unusual for an old person to choose what they called sequestering, a self-imposed exile where cold might put an end to all infirmities. I, too, respected Kettle's right to choose her life path, or die in the attempt. But it did not stop me from sending Night Eyes back down our trail to see if she was still coming. I chose to believe it was only curiosity on my part. He had just returned to camp with a bloody white hair in his jaws. At my request, he stood, stretched, and woefully commanded me,